This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from Tampa Bay's Tantalk Radio Network studio here in Clearwater. At the bottom of the hour, I have a special guest, Anne O'Farrell, a lovely Irish woman who's going to tell us about her absorbing family saga that's set in rural Ireland in the 20s and 30s. And stay tuned for that, because she has a delightful lilting voice and it's a joy to listen to her. But first, I want to go to New York Times best-selling author Ace Atkins. Hi, Ace.
Hello, good morning. How are you?
Okay. Well, I wasn't sure what kind of an accent you'd have.
It depends on who I'm talking to. I can change it. I can do Mississippi, and I can do Boston, and I'm not sure Tampa has an accent, but I used to live there for many years, and I know it well. So
yes, of course you do, because it was here that you were here when you were nominated for the Pulitzer Prize.
Yep, I worked for the Tampa Tribune for many years, and before that I worked for the then St. Pete Times, now the Tampa Bay Times.
Yes, they've switched around, joined forces, and I never know what their name is, but this is where you got your start, right? You started off as a...
I did. I came pretty much fresh out of college. I came down and I started off as a very lowly correspondent for the St. Pete Times, to say the least, very lowly, and covered football games and that kind of thing, and then eventually became a staff writer at the Tampa Tribune, and that's where I really covered a lot of crime stuff and got into it. But I know the city very well, and I've covered all around Clearwater and St. Pete and Tampa, and anytime I go back, it's like coming home. It's a great place.
Well, I hope the next time you come to this area, you come and visit us. We're right here on Myrtle Street and in Clearwater, and we're just a few minutes from the beaches, so it's always so beautiful here.
Sounds perfect. I'd be glad to.
Now, of course, you started with your first crime fiction, but based on reality, real cases that you discovered, mm-hmm. and that's where you got into the story that got you nominated for the Pulitzer Prize. And then eventually you came out with your own series, and of course now this, I don't know, is it this month or in the past 2 months, you had two books released. First of all, The Innocents, which is of course the one, the Quinn Colson series.
Yes, that's just out today, and then the Spencer book, Robert B. Parker's Slow Burn, came out in May.
Wow, so you've been a busy guy.
I've been busy. The release date is, you know, pretty close together, but of course I don't write them at the same time. I'm writing them at different times, but the release date always comes on the heels of each other to be big summer books. And so, I've got to talk about Spencer, one of my all-time favorite characters that the estate has trusted me to continue writing about, and then now writing about my own southern character, Quinn.
When the Spencer estate selected you, I'm at a little disadvantage. This morning, I ran out of coffee. I had no coffee. And
I couldn't do that.
Oh, that's rough for me, because I'm a youper from Upper Peninsula in Michigan, and I live on coffee. And my printer didn't work, so I couldn't print out my notes about about this interview. But luckily, I know your work well enough that I don't think I need my notes.
No, I don't think you're doing fine.
Because I've enjoyed your book so much, but I can't remember if did your first Quinn Colson book come out before you were selected by the Spencer estate, but to do the Spencer books?
It did. It was not long beforehand, but I think that's possibly how I came to the attention of Mr. Parker, and I was fortunate to be at the same publishing house as Mr. Parker, who I just idolized for years and thought he was just wonderful, and I think I just started a series about the Ranger, and I think that some way my name got into the mix of possibly writing Spencer after they kind of saw the similarities, even though they're geographically very different. I think they saw some similarities between my work and Parker's work, and I was asked if I would like to try my hand at writing some pages for Spencer, and I said, you bet, he's one of my all-time favorite characters, and I did it, and I was lucky enough after the family saw it, and the folks at Putnam and his longtime agent, they were unanimous to select me to write Spencer, and I've been doing now Spencer for over 5 years.
Well, and the important thing is the fans accepted you. Yeah, it was really...
The fans, and you know, and that could have gone one or two ways. You never know how that's going to go, but the fans have been really... been terrific, and they just, you know, it's, I think it's really a testament to Parker and creating this wonderful character of Spencer, and you know, what a tribute. You know, I hope it's a long time before I leave this earth, but you know, when I do, I hope people want more Quinn, and I think that was the ultimate tribute to Bob Parker.
Well, I think so, and now when you do the research for the Spencer books, do you go, you have to go up to Boston?
Oh,
and
yeah. Oh, so yeah,
infuse,
yeah,
yourself
I'm
with
the beat. It's a great city. You know, it's just a great city, and I've got to really, I have some wonderful friends up there now, and some of them were Bob Parker's friends, and got to really have a nice network up there, and got to know everybody. And you know, you mentioned the name that Spencer. He's the hero of Boston, and you know, I recently wrote a book, Slow Burn, that just came out about the Boston Fire Department, and I made a call to the Boston Fire Department. They said, hey, whatever you want, whatever you need to see, we'll do it. And it just could not have been nicer about it. So it's a wonderful city to get to know and a wonderful city to write about. I really do enjoy it a great deal.
And then, of course, we have the Quinn Colston books. And for that, you've created an entire county.
That's right. So not as much research, you know, because it is my own backyard, but it's a fictional county here in North Mississippi, and it's a kind of a rough and tumble place called Tippahaw County, and it's based on two or three different counties that are close to where I live, you know, I make no bones about it, Mississippi is a wonderful place. There's a lot of great things about it, with music and food and culture, but it also is a very dysfunctional place, and there's, you know, we're number one for corruption and last in education, and there's a lot of stuff to write about down here.
Well, I'm also on podcast, so I was just showing that in the front of your book, you've got a map of Tippahaw County. You've got all
yep.
the details, and I know that you're so detailed about it that you know exactly every part of the county, and so that's part of why your books are so realistic. From Northern Michigan, people up there don't sort of have a strange feeling toward the South. You know, we grew up with not understanding the South. And I think I was one of the few people who read Faulkner. Because nobody up north read Faulkner.
I think that's been partly the success of the series, is that people are very interested in the South. The South is a kind of a mysterious, interesting, weird place, and people want to know more about it. And you know, I don't pull any punches with it. It is, I could tell you, I could take you here and show you some wonderful places to eat and listen to music, and there's some great stuff that goes on here, and it's a very diverse place, but there's some bad stuff that happens here. But I think that the popularity of the series has been really, there's not many books that are written about the Deep South in this particular way, which I would say more realistic way. There are books that are, you know, what you call like Moonlight and Magnolias, and glorifying the South and how lovely.
Oh, there are a lot of cozy mysteries written about the South.
Yeah. And then there's books, you know, they're making the, you know, all the South look like Mississippi burning, and that's not necessarily true either. There's kind of a weirder place that kind of hits reality for me.
Well, I think particularly with your character Quinn Colston is a really special guy, and I recently was talking to CJ Box, and I loved what he said. Gave you a nice quote for your book. You created a real American hero with Quinn.
That's a nice thing to say coming from him. He's one of my favorite authors, and he's also a buddy of mine, great guy.
Oh, he is. He's fantastic.
And those Joe Pickett books are just wonderful. And I think, you know, that's kind of the genesis for Quinn Colston, that there are these heroes that we read that, out west, you know, you read the C.G. Bach's Joe Pickett books, and then I'm a big fan of the Robert Craze books that are out on the West Coast. And you've got Spencer up in Boston, and all these different regions have these characters that are the heroic characters that kind of represent these places. But I didn't really find anything in the Deep South. There wasn't really anything to kind of fill that void to write about. And so, much like those books, I wanted to create kind of an iconic Southern hero. And that's where Quinn came about.
And you did. Quinn is a ranger who comes back, who becomes a sheriff of his town, and then, of course, through the series, different things happen to him. But that he's always essentially that ranger character, that brave guy who was in Afghanistan and on countless.
He's a stoic, definitely a stoic character, and kind of cut from the mold of some of the old Western heroes like Gary Cooper, Clint Eastwood, or that kind of thing. He's a man of few words, but that's okay because everyone in the book has so much to say.
Yes, they're all
a lot of people who do a lot of talking for him. I think the simplicity of the books is just here's a guy who left his town, and it could be upstate Michigan, or it could be a rural town in Florida, or it could be this is a common story: is a man or woman returns home from the front, and they're finding that the world that they left is maybe as dysfunctional and as dangerous as corrupt as what they were trying to fight over overseas.
Well, I have a feeling that quite a bit of your research for Quinn is probably done over beer.
True, and for Spencer too. A lot of beer drinking to get the feel of the series right, for sure.
And to get the guys talking, because you make it you make it so real. You really bring in that realism of what it meant to be a ranger, what it means to be that type of. It just makes me crazy when I think of all of these American boys going overseas, going to Afghanistan, where they're facing things that are really almost unimaginable, and how they have to be strong if they're going to survive it, and then come back. And
so many of them are so young. I mean, it's like Quinn is a much younger man than I am, and he would have been around 20 in 1920, 9/11, and those guys. There's and many of them. Most of the Rangers, most of the people that, most of the men that are in the Rangers are very young, just fresh-faced kids, and they're going over there and just young guys. Somebody told me one time that had been a Ranger, he had gotten out when he was like 27, and he said he was an old man to be a Ranger at 27, and it's just like a high-paid athlete. They're just young, very athletic, tough people that have to do some really tough jobs. As very young people, young men.
And now, speaking of athletic, I should mention that you're also famous. Yeah, you're famous for many things, not just being a New York Times bestseller and a Pulitzer Prize nominee, but also you were on the cover of Sports Illustrated, and not very many writers can say that.
A long, long time ago. When I was, I played a long. It was a long time. It's getting. It's been. Oh boy, I don't even want to think about 23 years. Wow. I played football at Auburn University, and we had a really good season that year. And I was kind of capping off the season. They had a special edition of Sports Illustrated for Auburn University's undefeated team, and I got to be on the cover. So it also served as the Sports Illustrated jinx, which is I never made it to the pros. I had to become a newspaper reporter. So it worked. It worked both ways.
But I guess if you didn't become a professional player, at least you did get on the cover, so that must have made your father, of course, was a football coach, right? So
he was a professional football player and a professional coach. Worked for the NFL for almost 30 years, and so I decided not to get into the world of coaching or the world of football or athletics and get out and become a newspaper writer, which wasn't probably too wise, because I got in the business probably the last 5 years that it was really it was really in existence, and I got to kind of experience the last good old days of print journalism, which was just invaluable, and I miss my time, but probably maybe the happiest time of my life was working at the Tampa Tribune and working with some real old pros. And I learned pretty much all I know about writing from some great, great editors there.
Was Colette Bancroft there when you were there?
Well, she at the Times, the Times, and the majority of my career, I was at the Tribune.
Ah, okay, because I know she loves your book. She was on my program too, and so
she's great.
She is fantastic.
She's the Times is an outstanding paper, and that's one of the last good book pages in the United States, and that's a credit to her that she continues to run a top notch book page when most papers have folded that long time ago.
And yeah, it's true. She does. She's an amazing woman. So, and of course, she always reviews your books and loves them. And you know, with the Quinn Colson, as you said, now you want this character to be carried on. But I have a feeling you've got like how many more books are you going to do?
Hey, as long as people are reading them and they're excited about the character and they want to come down south and experience some of the southern grit down here, I will keep on writing them. I think there's an unlimited amount of stories for Quinn because the line of work and the nature of the South and nature of Mississippi, but also his job is, you know, working in the sheriff's office. I mean, there is just limitless stories that you can tell. And I've already, you know, I'm excited about the next book. I've got a pretty mapped out as far as what the, you know, Quinn 7 is going to be, and I can't wait to delve into it.
And of course, you're right there. You're in Oxford, Mississippi.
Mississippi.
Which, of course, Oxford is the home of William Faulkner, and I know that you bring in Faulkner references in your stories sometimes.
Yes, and some people get them and some people don't, you know, so you're one of the few who gets it. You know, I always have characters who are, you know, related some way to Faulkner's characters, and I kind of think of some of my people as being the descendants of some of the Faulknerian characters. In this book, I've got a character named Wash Jones, who's this kind of unsavory, alcoholic lout. And there was a Wash Jones that was in Absalom, who was just a horrific person. And then I've got the character of Millie Jones, his daughter, who also was a character in Absalom. So I kind of like put a little sprinkling of Faulkner references in it. And some people get it and some people don't.
Well, I like that. I enjoy that. I sort of, I'm so proud of myself. I say, oh, yes, I get that one. So,
well, you are one of the few, so you should be proud of yourself. That's good. It's so funny. I'll mention names that people don't recognize from Faulkner, and I think they're such famous characters, you know. That's because you have read Faulkner. You know Faulkner.
Yeah, exactly. And there are many things that you know are interesting about Faulkner, and one of the things, of course, I was thinking about it this morning. Maybe I should when I. Having read your book, I don't have coffee, but I wish I had a bourbon. You know, throw a little over ice, maybe that would get me going, because I can't believe I'm going to survive the whole morning with a cup of water. But I know
I
that
I could not do it. I would be making a beeline after you finish with this. Make a beeline right to Starbucks.
Oh, I am. I can't believe it. I'm looking at this cup of water. It's like.
No.
I don't believe this.
I've been doing interviews this morning, but I have a extra jumbo, huge cup of coffee here, and I could not be thinking straight without it.
I know it's a crazy thing. I had Dr. Bob Arnott on recently, and he came out with a coffee, his own coffee, just because he wanted a strong coffee, and so that's how I'm at the moment. But I know you're a big fan of bourbon.
Yes, bourbon and coffee, depending on the time of the day. I do enjoy a little bourbon now and again, and certainly living down in Faulkner country, it's just kind of a prerequisite. You gotta like bourbon, and it is very much part of the whole Southern culture feeling. And one of those things, I guess, I remind people about the South has many strikes against it in many different ways, but you know, we did give people bourbon, and we did give people blues music and jazz, and so there's some great stuff that's come out of the South too.
And of course, one of the great things are the Quinn Colson books, because I think, as I said, what you mentioned, that all of the characters, the other characters in the book, talk a lot, and they become so real. It's really. A tribute to you that you're able to do that. You know, they're not there's not a lot of, let's say, pretty fluff in your books. They're very they're very straight and very clean writing, which of course that comes from your background as a journalist.
Well, there's, you know, as a journalist, you know, when I worked at the Tribune or worked at the Times, when you'd come and tell a story and you'd go all the way around before you get to the point, you'd be shunned and, you know, tossed out of the building. So you had to get to the point pretty quickly. And I always think about that, which is, what is the point? You know, and what are we, you know, tell us a story and get to it. And that came from a lot of editors, both at the Times and the Tribune, tearing up my copy and telling me to go back and do it again. It was just wonderful training.
Yeah, and that is something that's lost to the current generation of writers. They don't have anyone to do that. They can write the blogs, but they don't have anyone to, you know, say, okay, let's cut this, you know.
Hey, and you've got to have somebody being mean to you. You got to have somebody on you, and you got to have somebody just telling you what the way it is. And I did. I had some straight-ahead editors, you know, that would just tear my copy up, and I'm a much better writer for it. And, yeah, when you write, just like you said, for a blog, or you're doing something and you just want accolades and you don't want anyone to criticize you, there's no way of getting better. You got to have somebody watching over you. And I was fortunate to get in the last 5 years, really, the last 5-6 years of the old days of journalism, and I got to work with people. Some of the reporters have been there since the 40s. Many of them have been journalists since the 60s. And to be around those kind of people was just wonderful training.
Well, you know, of all of the things that have been said about you, one of the things is someone said, well, if he cut out the murders, he could be a Faulkner. So I thought that was a pretty nice compliment to you.
Well, that is nice. That is good. I've got I really do enjoy the style of the books, and I do enjoy the language of them, and I enjoy the writing dialogue, and I love, you know, writing the style of it. And I, you know, sometimes the crime itself is secondary. It's really about the people, and if the people don't click for you and the family relationships and Quinn's background and the town and everything, if that doesn't work, then we don't have anything. And that's, to me, the key thing and the most important.
Well, you certainly have done a great job with The Innocents. I think it's a fantastic book. Really, it's spellbinding. When, you know, we talk about spellbinding, but I wanted the let's say murder, whatever, doesn't occur right at the beginning, and it just have to you build up toward it, and you know something's going to happen, and you don't know what's going to happen, and so you can't stop reading, and you keep going, and it's a very 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 great, really a great book. I'm really.
Well, thank you. I greatly. That makes me feel good. It's funny when you've written a book and then it's, you know, it's goes into production and you kind of you know, go on other projects and you kind of forget about it. So on the day of publication, that's a very nice thing to hear, for sure.
Well, I'm just so happy that I got to talk to you, and especially on the day that it comes out. And I think it's going to be a great another bestseller for you, because it's a wonderful story. And as
Thanks
I said.
So much.
I know that so much of it, the ideas and the character of Quinn comes through your talks with all of our veterans, and I so admire all of the veterans, and I know that.
Yeah, I do too.
You know, just buy them a beer for me, because I just admire what they do and how they have been able to survive their time overseas. So, just wonderful to talk to you.
Yep, I could not agree more. Good people to when I have sources to talk about. I would not have Quinn without having some real life people to talk to. So it's built the entire series for sure.
Absolutely. Okay. Well, thank you so much again. I was just
thank you very much.
Wonderful
Enjoyed
to talk
it.
To you. Okay.
Good. We'll talk again soon.
Okay. Bye bye, Ace. Wow, that was great. When we come back, I'm going to have Anne O'Farrell on, and she's a lovely Irish lady, and she's going to talk to us about her book. So we'll be back in a few minutes.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida, can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660, or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Hi, I'm John Rakowski with Charles Ruttenberg Realty. Don't you love living here in the Tampa Bay area? Oh, I'm sorry, you don't live here yet? Well, if you already are or thinking about it, call me at my office at 727-538-9200 extension 2 for any real estate needs, including a free market analysis of your home. Your home is worth more than you can imagine. Call me today at 727-538-9200 extension 2. I'm John Rakowski.
This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
With a special guest today, Anne O'Farrell. Hi, Anne.
Hi, Patsy.
Oh, well, now we're going to hear a lovely accent. You're from Dublin.
I am from Dublin, Ireland. Yes, indeed.
Oh, it's so, I just love the accent so much. You can just talk about anything, you know, I will just listen to the accent. Anyway, Anne is a great author, and she has written how many books now?
Five
books. And you started writing when you came?
I did.
To Florida,
When I came to Florida, I started to write goofy letters home about the difference between here and there. Uh-huh. And somebody said, why don't you join a writer's group? I joined the writer's group, and everybody else was writing novels. And I thought, yikes, perhaps I'd better try. And that's how it started.
And it's been rather magical, because your books are rather magical. There's an element of, there's something special in these books.
Well, thank you very much. They're all based on true stories, and I felt very strongly each one that I wrote that I wanted to write them. It wasn't a have to, it was I wanted to.
And when you say true stories, where did the stories come from?
Well, if we start with Nora's Children, which is the first book I wrote, and you know when you're a small child and you're listening to adults speaking, and as long as you stay quiet, you hear things you're not supposed to hear. And I could hear the grown-ups going on about, how could anybody do that to their children? How could anybody treat children like that? And I was killed with curiosity to find out what. But of course, as a child, if you say, what are you talking about? Immediately it's you. Bed, or they stop talking. So either way, you don't hear. So this kind of lurked in the back of my mind, and I was always curious as to what was going on. And as I got older, I asked a few questions. Some answers I got, some answers I didn't get. And this is why they're novels and not true stories per se, but they are all based on true stories. And I did actually meet some of the children of the children in Nora's Children, and they confirmed my research about the sadness, the happiness, the extraordinary lives they all led.
So tell us a little bit about what in Nora's Children.
Nora's Children. It begins in the west of Ireland. It's a young couple, Brendan and Nora Kelly, who have five small children rather quickly, which is what happens in Ireland, big families. But sadly, when the youngest child, Michael, is only 2 years of age, Nora, the mom, dies. So now he has to find Brendan. The husband has to find a mother for his children. He can't stop work. He has to continue working. He's a carter. So he takes them all off to an old aunt, Auntie Bridgie, and asks her to mind them while he goes off to find himself a match. And indeed, he does find himself a match and weds. And the day after the marriage, he's to come back and collect his children and bring them home. And the children are all excited, and Auntie Bridgie is looking forward to it. And when he arrives, sadly, it is to say, I've changed my mind and I don't want those children after all. And Auntie Bridgie is distraught, and she's going, but this is why you got married. They're your children. Nothing would change his mind. He wouldn't take them. Auntie Bridgie couldn't look after them. She's an old lady, five small children. But she couldn't put them into an orphanage, which is what he told her to do. And so the story is about what happened to those children after that.
Wow, you know, it is a very dramatic story. And I'm wondering, you know, now it's your first novel.
It is.
Wow, how it came out, you know, Really? Well done. How did you, you know, not having written before, well, just was inspiring?
My background is in theater. I was a theater director. I studied theater in university. And so I tell people I hear voices, but that gets them a little nervous. But I hear how people speak. I hear how they interact. And so I knew the story. I also worked with children an awful lot. I worked as a drama therapist with children with problems or problem children. And so this was a good way for me to explore how five very different young children would react to a major drama like this and a major trauma. So that's what I was researching. And that's how the story evolved.
Well, you've tapped into, of course, the lovely Irish storytelling, which Irish people are famous for it, and you've tapped into that, and at the same time, I mean, it's quite an amazing first novel. You've done a brilliant job.
Thank you, I appreciate that.
So, you know, I don't know, how long did it take you as a new writer coming to it?
That's the magical question, and I do get asked quite frequently. And I think the answer, my husband would give a different story to myself, because I would lie in bed at night and toss and turn, and once I made sure he was awake, I go, this story is bothering me, I want to write the story, I don't know how to start the story, I need to start, and he would go, pick up a pen or go to the computer and do it. So it took a long time for me to have the courage to begin. But once I did, it took me about a year to write.
Wow. That is remarkable.
Thank you.
So did you work with a writing group at some point?
I did. I worked with, when I began, I worked with a writer's group, the Tarpon Springs Writers Group, and they were tremendous. I would have to confess a story which I do explain to people. I had thought I was going to write the story of the youngest child. And so the book begins, Nora's Children begins with his birth, because that I thought that was a fairly good place to start. But as this little boy came to be about a year old, a year and a half old within my book, I'm trying to make him say his first words. And I couldn't. I couldn't get this little boy to speak. And then I realized that I had to write the backstory. I had to write why he couldn't speak, what caused his reserve and his caution. So I wrote Nora's Children, explaining the backstory. So it was a flow for me. It began with young Michael, and that was intended to be the first book, but in fact that ended up as the second book. And everybody says, what clever marketing. I didn't intend it to be clever marketing. It just happened that way.
Sometimes that's what happens. The story just takes you where it wants to go.
Sure.
And so
it was Michael's story I was writing, but then I realized I was writing the story of all of Nora's children.
Well, it's a wonderful book. And as you said, it led to the second book.
It did indeed, Michael.
And tell us about Michael.
Michael, bless his heart, he was coming up to 3 years of old, 3 years of age when this happened. And so the poor little mite is theoretically adopted by a couple in England, but the man of the household adopted two children, a little girl and a little boy. And he finally decided that little boy was no good. He didn't want a little boy. His wife wanted a little girl to dress up. So he didn't know what to do with this child. And eventually he decided he would give young Michael, age 3, to his sister, who was a spinster lady, who was a seamstress. And he literally hands Michael over at the beginning of the second novel and says, here you are. Here's a child for you. He'll look after you in your old age. And that was the simple purpose that Michael then existed. He was being reared to look after this woman when she could no longer look after herself. There was very little love. There was very little concern for him at all. He was very fortunate that during his young life he did meet people who did care for him. Nuns in the school, or some of the nuns in the school, his best friend. But he was pretty much out there on his own. And It was the, I never mentioned when all these books are set, but they begin in about 1922. Nora's Children begins in 1922. And then we're in the 1930s when we're dealing with Michael and coming up to the First World War in England. And he's a very confused young man. He doesn't know where he came from. He doesn't know his antecedents. He just knows that the Irish are hated, and he understands that he's from Irish stock and therefore not liked, not wanted. And it's how he develops and how he grows up and finally meets somebody who really cares for him and how much it changes his life.
Well, it's, again, you've touched on something so intriguing, the story of the idea that a child could just be handed over to somebody.
As casually. There were no formal documents. There was no paperwork. There was just, I'll take it. I would have to say that in Ireland, to a degree, that was, I won't say a very frequent occurrence, but it did occur because they had large families. And if the mother died, the father couldn't look after all the children. And they were handed off. Does anybody want somebody? They were taken in. If they were older, they were taken in as servants in households or to work on the fields. It's much like the children here that were put on the trains, the orphan trains, same kind of thing. So it wasn't that unusual that children were handed off. But
well, in Nora's Children, you capture the time, I think, very well, the period. Did you have to do a lot of research for that?
I'm old enough. I'm not.
Well, you're not, old enough that to. Period. You were there. That's long.
No, I'm not of that period. But Ireland was a country that was slow to develop. It was governed by Britain for about 700-800 years. So in rural Ireland, there wasn't electrification until the 1950s, and certainly that is within my lifespan. So country life had not changed for hundreds of years, really. And so if you're talking about a small village in the west of Ireland, very easy to imagine what it would have been like. I know when I was growing up, there were what they call shawlies, old women in the countryside. They didn't wear coats. They wore great big black shawls. And so the shawlies would have been all over the village. You would have recognized them. And it was a simple way of life, and it continued to be a simple way of life in rural Ireland, and still is in many places, believe me.
Okay, we can take a trip there and see it.
Absolutely, it's quite beautiful.
But they probably all have cell phones now. All the Shawleys have cell phones.
They probably do, and they probably were very, very offended for me to call them Shawleys, but that's what we knew them as.
Well, if you go to Africa now, every person you see, I mean,
sure.
A child will have a cell phone. It's strange, but you're right. I lived in England for quite a few years, and in a small village called Sonny, and well, of course, it was preserved because they didn't want it to change. So it was really quite lovely because they didn't allow any building. So it was nice, and they had to be very adamant about it to not let anybody come in.
Indeed.
And build a high rise in the middle of town.
It wasn't a concern in Ireland. There was not any great industry in Ireland, so it was easy to keep it.
Well, the nice thing about your stories, of course, there are so many people who do. Well, of course, Americans who have a connection with Ireland, there are so many who are part Irish. I mean, there's like,
yes, indeed,
every half the people you meet, they say, I'm part Irish.
And most of them are Irish on St. Patrick's Day.
Oh, yes, exactly. As a matter of fact, I started my program on St. Patrick's Day.
Yes, very good.
In 2015, yes. So I felt very, very Irish that day.
Irish.
So I think people relate very well to that sort of Irish.
Yes, they do. I think that's. I've been very fortunate. People have asked if my books are for sale in Ireland, and I say no, and they kind of look a little surprised. And like, well, you know, this would be too recognisable a story in Ireland, but over here, and there are only 4.5 million people in the whole of Ireland. There are.
Oh, that's hard to imagine.
I know.
I mean, it's really, it is tiny. When you think about it.
It's tiny. There are 4 million Irish Americans in Wisconsin alone. So, and there are over 40 million Irish Americans within the USA. So, yes, the books are becoming very well known here all over. I'm very fortunate. I'm invited to Irish festivals and associations. They're all over America. I talked myself to a standstill last summer doing book tours. They are very well received because everybody has Irish connections, I think, or almost everybody has Irish connections.
Exactly. And the stories are very, I think they touch a special part of the heart because, you know, they're very, very good. And so that was your second book. Michael was your second book. Then you went on. And what was your third book?
The third book, well, it's easy if I say Nora's Children is a trilogy. And the third book was by popular demand. Well, I like to think so anyway. That everybody wanted to know what happened to the children when they grew up. What happened next? What happened next? Oh, lordy, lordy, I had never intended to do it. I had only ever intended to write one book. But I said, okay, fine. So I wrote the final book in the trilogy called Going Home, which has many different meanings. And wrote about how the children fared once they were adults. And then I slammed the door closed on the Kellys, and I said, there will be no more Kellys.
But you did get to meet...
I got to meet the children of some of the children uh-huh. of the children. And they did confirm for me what I had found. One of the things that I found very sad, the eldest boy, Pierce, had a particularly unhappy life. It's not... If Frank McCourt is a box of tissues, then Nora's Children is maybe two or three tissues. But there is sadness in it. And Pierce, as the oldest child, probably had the worst experiences. And I talked to his children, and they said, you know, when we asked him about his childhood, he would simply cry. He would just, even as a man, an old man, he would cry about what happened to him as a child.
Well, they have to read your books to find out why, and they have
indeed.
To... indeed. And it's nice that your books are going to be available locally now at our local author's book nook.
I'm thrilled.
It's so exciting that we now have this ability to feature local authors at the book nook at Miami Avenue. And so...
It's a treasure of a place. Well, whatever about having the books there, there's so much to see there and so much that is a joy to look at. The artwork, the craft work is beautiful.
It is. And I'm so pleased that we've had such a turnout, and I'm sure your books are going to be successful because they're just good reads and very heartwarming to sit down and to read your books. So I just want to thank you so much. Anne O'Farrell. Now, do you have a web page?
I do, and it's very simple, www.anneofarrell.net.
Okay, so everybody can go there also, and of course she's on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, wherever you can buy books. But definitely have a look at Anne O'Farrell's books, because I think you'll find them just a fascinating read and a lot of fun. And if you're in our area, come over to the Book Nook, and you'll be able to pick one up.
Patsy, thank you very much indeed.
Okay, well, thank you so much for coming in the studio today, Anne.
Thank you.
Oh, it was lots of fun. I just listened to you for hours. Okay.
Take care.
Okay, thanks. Bye now.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Charles Ruttenberg Realty proudly sponsors Joy on Paper with Patsy Gill. Charles Ruttenberg sets the standard of excellence with residential and commercial real estate transactions and can help you on your next transaction, whether that is for a second home, investment, or downsizing. Call us today at 727-538-9200 extension 2 and allow me to help you. I'm John Rakowski, the broker at Charles Ruttenberg Realty.
Larson & Larson is a proud sponsor of Joy on Paper. Our law firm has the experience and knowledge to help you protect your valuable intellectual property. From trademark, copyright, and patent applications to negotiating licensing agreements, the attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida, are here to advise you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at larsonpatentlaw.com. That's Larson & Larson, your intellectual property attorneys.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z. Well, it was great to talk to my guests today. I hope they've inspired you to write. Anne is just such a charming, lovely woman, and she took the stories that she heard as a child and wrote books about them. It's a process. I was talking to another author recently who also is taking the stories that he remembers from his childhood and is working to turn them into a book. Now, everybody has this idea that an author is born with talent and you either have it or you don't have it. But the fact is that the human mind is an amazing thing, and you don't know what's inside there unless you try. And researchers have found recently that it's not so much the talent that you think you're born with, it's a talent that you allow your mind to develop, having a plastic mind, a mind that will move around. And part of that comes from taking in more and more information and just letting your mind roam with that information. And for example, I was talking recently to Clive Cussler, and I'm going to have him on again next week. And he started off as a mechanic on a flight line in Korea, and he had no idea that one day he would have a quarter billion books. It was simply a matter he let his mind roam. He did more and more things. He started skin diving and looking for treasure, and just one thing after another led him to the point where he had so much going on in his mind that when he decided to sit down and start writing, there were lots of ideas, and of course then he had to fine-tune his talent. And some, when you have talent, and you know you have talent, it's a matter of bringing it out. Now, with my earlier guest today, and it's beautiful, Ace Atkins, his book is really interesting from the point of view of how he's developed as a writer. I went back and I looked at his first maybe one or two books, and they weren't that great. But at some point, he just improved and improved his writing, and his writing is really clean and crisp. And part of course, what he mentioned that he had the opportunity to work for a newspaper, which was great training in those days. It's almost impossible now to get on a newspaper. There are so few of them. But if you can find a newspaper that will take your stories, that's a great training. One of my favorite writers, Carol Perry, who writes cozy mysteries, I know that she wrote for small magazines. She wrote for antique furniture magazines. And first of all, she wrote the ads. She wrote the little stories. And again, this was just good training. If you're working on a story and you are trying to improve, you have to improve as a writer. And you don't improve by writing the same thing. You have to stretch yourself. One of the best ways, really, is to analyze other writers. Take a book of somebody's book that you admire and sit with it and say, okay, if I was going to rewrite this sentence, how would I rewrite it? And then after a while, you say to yourself, well, that sentence is really perfect. I couldn't rewrite it. then you're starting to see the process. You're starting to understand what that writer was doing and then understand what you have to do. As I mentioned in the book that Ace Atkins, his recent book, there's a development of the story. There's foreshadowing. You know something's going to happen. And all of it is very subtle. And, of course, it's told a lot through, as he mentioned, his characters talk a lot. And so it's a fascinating process how he builds up the excitement of the book. And, again, his book is a great one to analyze. I think one of the best writers to analyze if you're writing a modern-day thriller is C.J. Box. His books are very crisp, very clean, and as you study his sentences, you'll say to yourself, wow, that's a good sentence, and how can I write a sentence like that? And Carol Perry, if you're looking for inspiration for a cozy mystery, her cozy mysteries are just really delightful. And again, when you read her books and you analyze the sentences, say to yourself, how could I write that better? And if you can't, then understand that what you've discovered here is that you've discovered what really fine writing is, and that you have to then take yourself aside and say, okay, I'm going to try not to copy, but to emulate, to find those same sentences that are going to be so good that nobody would want to come and rewrite them. And it's part of the process. And there's a nice book that's came out recently. It's called Peak, and it's called Secrets from the New Science of Expertise. And it's not necessarily about writing, but it's about how you envision yourself, how you see your success, and how you can build it from step by step of not just doing the same thing, trying new things. And that's the only way that you are going to improve yourself. So all of those ideas are something that you should think about. Of course, part of it is that you just have to write and then try to find yourself a group to work with if you have no experience in writing. It's always wonderful when you can get some feedback on your work. So that is something that you should look for. Meanwhile, it's going to be... Today is Tuesday. It's karaoke night at the Miami Avenue Wine Bar and Art Studio Gallery. It's a wonderful place to go, and we have there now the local author's book nook is at Miami Avenue, and it's in on Second Street, Indian Rocks Beach. And it's a wonderful time if you go there this evening to do some karaoke and have some fun and drink some wine and then have a look at the author's books that they put in there. You'll have a wonderful choice. All genres, from cozy mysteries to thrillers to self-help books, and even a wonderful book about hot rods. If you like books about cars, we have some really great books there. So take yourself over to the Miami Avenue Wine Bar. And meanwhile, just find your joy and share it, and have a great time. Bye.